he will still keep nuclear weapons, which he believes are vital for his own physical survival.
Diplomacy appears difficult with Kim Jong-un. It's Friday, August 25th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us too on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, battling terrorism and differing views in Kashmir. U.S. and Chinese commercial cooperation in space. An Indian movie to urge the use of toilets. A walking polymer and Asian American perspectives of an L.A. riot. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The prospect of reaching any diplomatic solution to the North Korean nuclear threat remains unclear, as its leader Kim Jong-un has shown little willingness to compromise with adversaries in Washington or even to engage with allies in Beijing. Political analyst Choi Kong is with the Asan Institute in Seoul.
I think he's a true believer in hardline policy because actually completion of nuclear as well as nuclear program, missile and nuclear program, is one of the strongest factors legitimize his power, his control of the regime.
After taking power in late 2011 following the death of his father, Kim Jong-il, there were questions as to whether the young Western-educated North Korean leader would liberalize the long-standing repressive rule of his country and whether he would even be able to consolidate his grip on power. Yet analysts say Kim has enhanced his image as a strong leader by following in the footsteps of his father and his grandfather, Kim Il-sung, the founding leader of North Korea, with his policies to bolster the country's nuclear deterrent against the United States and to improve the economy. The third-generational leader of North Korea has not cultivated friendly ties with China and has repeatedly ignored Beijing's repeated calls for Pyongyang to refrain from engaging in provocative ballistic missile and nuclear tests and to return to international denuclearization talks. Even though North Korea relies on China for diplomatic protection and 90% of its economic trade, Kim has still not met with Chinese President Xi Jinping, in contrast to his father, who repeatedly visited Beijing during his tenure. Professor Andrei Lankov, a North Korean analyst with the Kukmin University in Seoul, says the younger Kim seems to view China differently.
He does not see China as an ally. For him, China is a source of potential threat. The only country which can effectively intervene into the North Korean domestic affairs and probably even engineer a replacement of Kim Jong-un by another leader.
The aggressive North Korean leader seems to have also made the calculation that Beijing values stability over denuclearization. Choi Kong with the Asan Institute says Kim feels China will not impose such harsh conditions that would trigger an influx of refugees at the border or a collapse of Kim's regime that would lead to a U.S. and South Korea takeover of the entire Korean peninsula.
China is so much concerned with the possibility of unstable regime in North Korea. So he said, here I am, so don't push me too hard. Otherwise, there is going to be instability kinds of things.
Kim's critics, like high-level defector Tae Yong-ho, Pyongyang's former deputy ambassador to Britain, says the North Korean leader uses diplomacy only in support of his long-term goal to develop a strong nuclear arsenal that includes developing intercontinental ballistic missiles that can strike the United States or any target in the world.
The line of, you know, diplomacy or inter-Korean relations should be interpreted in terms of North Korean interest as a kind of, you know, tactics to buy the time.
Pyongyang responded to UN sanctions imposed in March 2016 after North Korea conducted a nuclear test and a rocket launch by declaring its country a nuclear state and accelerating missile and nuclear testing. But many analysts, like Professor Andrei Lankarov, are skeptical that even imposing a crippling economic blockade would force the North Korean leader to capitulate.
He probably would be ready to sacrifice farmers who will starve to death in the remote provinces, but he will still keep nuclear weapons, which he believes are vital for his own physical survival.
Diplomacy proponents like South Korean President Moon Jae-in advocate a mix of economic sanctions and dialogue to persuade the Kim regime to eventually adhere to UN restrictions in exchange for concessions and security guarantees linked to verifiable denuclearization progress. But skeptics expect that no matter the costs, Kim Jong-un will continue undeterred with missile and nuclear tests until his military has reached an effective long-range nuclear strike capability level. Our appreciation goes out to VOA correspondent Brian Padden and Yuumi Kim in Seoul for contributing to this report. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. Pakistan tells the United States to eliminate terror safe havens in Afghanistan. U.S. terror label on Kashmiri group not likely to curb violence. India's Supreme Court affirms constitutional right to privacy. Kim Jong-un shows little interest in diplomacy. Defamation case dropped against BBC reporter in Thailand. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are online at Facebook at VOA Asia and on our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. India scored a major diplomatic victory over Pakistan earlier this month when the United States designated the largest militant group fighting against Indian rule in the divided Kashmir region as a foreign terrorist organization. For India, the terror tag for the banned Hizbul Mujahideen, or HM, has come as a strong affirmation of its argument that the violence in its only Muslim-majority region is fueled by Islamic militant groups that operate from Pakistan, what India has long called cross-border terrorism. Islamabad denies the charges. HM was established in 1989 when the insurgency erupted in India-administered Kashmir. The United States declared its founder and supreme commander a global terrorist in June. New Delhi accuses the Hizbul Mujahideen, along with other Islamic militant groups, of killing thousands of people since the armed separatist rebellion erupted in Kashmir. Ajay Sani, who heads the Institute of Conflict Management in New Delhi, says there is a huge database of such attacks and the reason why the United States has designated them as a terror group.
They are repeatedly attacking civilian targets, killing civilians through acts of indiscriminate violence and sometimes targeted acts of violence.
Pakistan's foreign ministry and the HM have both rejected the terror tag as unjustified. Pakistani authorities and Kashmiri leaders maintain the armed insurgency is an indigenous political and legitimate struggle of Kashmiris strictly confined to the Himalayan region with a mission to free Kashmir from Indian occupation. Dismissing Islamabad's argument, Indian Foreign Ministry spokesman Ravish Kumar said,
"All of us are aware the kind of activities they are involved in. All of us are aware what kind of terrorist activities they have conducted in the state of Jammu and Kashmir. And frankly, the statement which has been made by Pakistan is something which is very strange, to say the least."
Analysts say the terrorism designation of HM is another significant step President Donald Trump's administration has taken to politically and diplomatically align itself with India. They also see it as a major blow to intense diplomatic efforts Pakistan has undertaken over the past year to push hard to internationally project alleged atrocities Indian security forces have unleashed against innocent Kashmiris. A prominent separatist leader in Indian Kashmir, Mirwais Umar Farooq, sees no justification for the terror label, pointing to the fact that there are now an estimated 100 local recruits in the ranks of the Hizbul, he said.
"There is an indigenous aspect to the Kashmiri militancy, and these young boys, mainly who are joining the militancy today, are those boys who feel pushed to the wall. Most of them are the ones who have been subjected to, repression. Families have been harassed by the police. Even today, if you look at these organizations, they don't have any global agenda. They don't have any agenda like the Al Qaeda or the Taliban or others have in terms of." So I guess their focus has been mainly vis-a-vis, the Kashmir dispute, the Kashmir issue.
For many in Kashmir, the main grievance is New Delhi's failure to explore a political solution to the Kashmir dispute and alleged human rights violations by Indian security forces amid what many regard as heavy-handed efforts to stamp out militancy and control protests. Our thanks to Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad for sending us this report. Happening now in Asia, the United States Navy has suspended search and rescue efforts for sailors missing after the USS John S. McCain crashed with a merchant vessel last week near the Straits of Malacca and Singapore. The U.S. 7th Fleet identified one deceased and nine missing soldiers Thursday. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad that you're visiting with us this Friday on VOA Asia. In recent years, the U.S. space program has been supporting a broader range of commercial interests, which has led to more companies getting into the space business. One such U.S. company, NanoRacks, is a full-service operation that gets science experiments from around the world into space. The company made history recently with a client from China. VOA's Elizabeth Lee explains from Houston.
Imagine a post office for space. That is the job of NanoRacks, a space company just down the street from NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston.
So this thing stays up there.
For a price, NanoRacks can help almost anyone, anywhere, send an experiment in this box to the International Space Station.
We're all about democratizing access to space. It's really important to me that we involve as many nations as possible.
From a university in Vietnam to institutions in Eastern Europe and Peru, NanoRacks has helped customers in 30 countries get their experiments or satellites to space. One of their latest customers from the Beijing Institute of Technology made history by being the first experiment from China to be brought on board the International Space Station.
They're doing an experiment on DNA and how it mutates in microgravity.
But getting this Chinese experiment to the International Space Station was complicated because U.S. federal law prohibits NASA from working directly with China.
First, we brought it to the Obama administration. They were very concerned that there was no tie to the People's Liberation Army.
After 2 years, NanoRacks received approval from U.S. lawmakers and all the members of the International Space Station with a stipulation.
We had to make sure that there was no technology transfer, no IT connection to the space station. We had a creative solution. We said, okay, we'll make sure that we plug in this experiment and it's not even connected data-wise. We just disconnected our data cable, so we were just able to run power up to this thing.
The self-contained autonomous Chinese experiment spent about 3 weeks in space and returned to Earth.
On the science side, a lot of us scientists would welcome the partnerships. There are other issues that we don't think about. Much of the Chinese space program is done through the military.
And liftoff.
In the United States, space is turning into big business.
There's been a shift of federal funding into more of this commercial space transportation program.
You can't do deep space exploration alone. The American government cannot do it without the American private sector, and America cannot do it without international colleagues. It's too expensive, it's too long term.
Businesses such as NanoRacks see the globalization of space as the future. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Houston.
Elizabeth has some great video with her story. You can check it out at voanews.com. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news alert from VOA Asia, a powerful typhoon has left 12 people dead across southern China, where its strong winds and rain forced thousands of people to evacuate their homes and left flooding and power outages. Typhoon Hato killed 8 people in Macau. It was the strongest storm to hit the gambling hub in 50 years. Visit VOA Asia Facebook for stories and features daily. This is VOA Asia. As we continue now with VOA Asia, India's glitzy Bollywood movies and toilets have little in common, but they came together in a recent film that turns the spotlight on one of the most unglamorous challenges the country is tackling, open defecation. Starring a top hero, Akshay Kumar, Toilet, A Love Story, is the tale of a bicycle shop owner's struggle to build a toilet for his wife, who abandons him because she refuses to go into the fields like other women in the village. It is inspired by a true story of a woman in central India who walked out on her husband because there was no toilet in the house. The theme has resonance in a country where half of the 1.3 billion people defecate in the open, exposing them, especially women and children, to diseases. Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government is racing to build millions of toilets to meet its pledge to end open defecation by the year 2019. But the problem is also about changing behavior in a society where many people consider this a healthy practice. Nikhil Srivastav is a research director at the Research Institute for Compassionate Economics in New Delhi.
People associate it with Ayurveda, that like you get a morning walk, you get fresh air, and all sorts of like reasoning which they come up with.
Campaigners point out that statistics to the latrines constructed in thousands of villages are meaningless because barely half are being used. Can the film help by sparking a conversation around sanitation, especially in rural India? V.K. Madhavan, who heads WaterAid India, says Bollywood, after all, is one of the country's major influencers.
The fact that someone is willing to put their money and to go out and make a movie about it, I think is great. If it's going to trigger off 50,000 people who started to think differently about the issue, it could change the way some people think. I think it still has value.
The film highlights how women, faces covered, venture into fields before sunrise under the cover of darkness. Nikhil Srivastav says another stumbling block in the campaign to popularize toilets is India's centuries-old caste system in which only lower castes are supposed to clean toilets.
Often these latrines get unused and are taken away, broken down, used for storing cow dung cakes or other things which they think are need to be safe from water.
V.K. Madhavan, along with sanitation experts, stress that the battle will have to be won softly and warn that some cases of zealous officials coercing people to use newly constructed latrines to meet India's target of ending open defecation may be counterproductive.
You have to deal with the cultural nuances around it, to deal with old habits. You just need to be able to get people, you know, you need to get feet on the ground to be able to talk to people, convince them gradually over a period of time. It doesn't happen overnight. It just needs constant reinforcement.
Prime Minister Narendra Modi has praised the film as a good effort to further the message of cleanliness. We praise Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi for sending us the story. This news alert from VOA Asia, U.S. President Donald Trump will meet Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak for talks at the White House next month. Malaysia's foreign ministry said the leaders would further talk about national security, combating terrorism and extremism, along with trade. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, synthetic polymers, primarily plastics, are used to make a host of items, from paint to plastic bottles to sunglasses and even DVDs. Imagine what could be created with a plastic that can be made to shimmy or even crawl. Well, now a new polymer has been developed that actually walks like a caterpillar as it reacts to light. VOA's Deborah Block tells us about it.
Researchers in the Netherlands say the polymer material can walk when a single fixed light source shines on it.
What we use is a special type of plastic. It's made of a liquid crystalline polymer, which means that the compounds in there are like liquid crystals that we see in displays nowadays.
The motion is created when one side contracts in reaction to the ultraviolet light, while the other side expands inside a rectangular plastic frame, making a wave bulge. When the polymer absorbed the light, a shadow was created behind it. This self-shadowing is crucial to its movement.
We made this pre-curved shape so that when the light comes onto the film, it will illuminate one part, but the other one will be in a shadow, which means that as soon as the light goes on that one, it deforms. Put another piece of the film in the light, that will deform.
The light polymer's frame is shorter than the strip itself, causing it to protrude downward, enabling it to walk.
you need this this pre-buckled shape, which basically, that's why we also use this tiny plastic frame around, so that you always have those constraints on the film.
While fun to watch, the researchers say the material could have practical applications.
If we apply this material on solar panels in the desert, if the sandstorm comes, the panels are fouled and it's very difficult to get all the sand off, or somebody has to go there and clean it. This material, with the sunlight maybe even, is able to vibrate and get rid of the sand.
Another use could be in small robots, directed by light, that crawl into narrow spaces, moving small items. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
A new film by Korean-American filmmaker Justin Chon, Gook, explores the 1992 Los Angeles riots from an Asian-American perspective. As VOA Asia's David Byrd tells us, Chon borrowed from his real-life experience as an 11-year-old in Paramount, California, when he wrote and made the film.
This year marks 25 years since the Los Angeles riots following the non-guilty verdicts of several police officers who had been videotaped beating a black motorist. Justin Chon was just 11 when the riots broke out in Los Angeles, and his father's shoe store in Paramount, just across the freeway from South Central L.A., was looted during the riots. Chon used his family's experience when he wrote and directed Gook. The 36-year-old Korean-American says that he wanted to tell the story of the riots from an Asian-American perspective.
It's kind of, I was thinking, well, how would I tell it from a Korean-American's perspective? And I gestated on it for, like, you know, five years or so. So, yeah, it was like a kick in the butt when I found out other people were actually going to get their films made, and I felt like, okay, well, this is the 25th anniversary of the riots, no time better than now. So I hustled and made it happen very quickly.
Chon plays Eli, who, along with his brother Daniel, played by YouTube star David So, runs a shoe store. Most of their customers are black or Latino, which reflects their neighborhood's makeup. Many of the businesses along the dilapidated street are Korean-owned, including a bodega run by an old man, played by Chon's real-life father. When an 11-year-old orphaned black girl named Camilla, played by breakout star Simone Baker, begins to hang around the shoe store, she and the brothers develop a friendship. The relationship deepens even as the city around the trio begins to be fractured by violence and anger. Chon says that Camilla being 11 and facing a time of crisis echoes his own experience in 1992.
You process it differently as an 11-year-old. I think you process it in a way that's much more immediate needs. So I just was thinking about things that directly affected me, like, am I going to move? Am I going to change schools and make new friends? Those are like the main core things that I was thinking about, but I watched the news, and I saw the whole thing unfold. It was almost like watching a movie. And then it becomes this very personal thing when your dad picks up and leaves, and you know that he went there. You know, he went to go protect the store or whatever.
The director says that he tried to show the impact of the riots from several points of view.
Not just my family side. You know, you see it from both communities, and also how the Hispanic community, what their role was in it, and you just start to look at it more as like, you know, you start to analyze everything, and I started to analyze my experience as well. So if you notice, the main character, Camilla, she's 11 in the film, and I was 11 when it happened, so, you know, that's not a coincidence.
Gook was shot in black and white with cinematography by Ante Chung. It won this year's Next Prize, awarded by audiences, at the Sundance Film Festival. This film is unrated, but it does feature violence and language. Gook is open in select theaters across the United States. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to VOA Asia, and did you know? We're heard on some great radio stations around the world, like DZUP, 1602 AM Radio at the University of the Philippines in Diliman, Quezon City. Thanks to everyone there who's listening, and wherever you happen to be in the world. We'd love to hear from you. You can send us a message via Facebook. VOA Asia is the place to visit. You can also email us, voaasia@voanews.com. Our thanks to director Tracy Carter and engineer Carl Starling, managing editor Diane Gao, Ali Ogden and David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day.